Welcome to the Directing Animation Livecast with Scott Weiser. Now that I'm done directing the development and first episode of the second series of Space Station Animation, I'm joining up with Steamroller Animation to push the boundaries of the art form. Thanks to the support of so many of you, I'm continually developing more than 10 dynamic feature film pitches while mastering the art of telling deeply meaningful stories. Today, my guest is the wonderful Nora Toomey. Nora is one of the co-founders of Cartoon Saloon, also director on Secret of Kells, Breadwinner, and My Father's Dragon, that's on Netflix recently. Breadwinner was nominated for an Oscar as well. And she's been a producer also on Wolfwalkers and several other productions there at Cartoon Saloon. And I looked at something on your bio that said you were a voice actress. What have you voice acted in, Nora?
I think my fantastic career as a voice actor started with some screaming on The Secret of Kells. I think I did some background screaming for like when the Vikings were invading. And I did actually on Wolfwalkers, there's a very downtrodden housekeeper called Bridget who tries to, basically tells Robin that it's okay, just, keep working and you don't have to think and just do your job and everything will be fine. And before you know it, you'll be very old and bent over in that. I drew on my life as working in the animation industry for that role.
You did fantastic at that role. That actually stood out to me, the voice acting on that. I was like, oh, that's such a good performance. So that's wonderful. Anything else you'd like to add to that bio or correct or?
No, I mean, I guess between myself and my partners in Cartoon Saloon, Paul Young and Tom Moore, we swap over roles quite a bit. So it's great to be in supportive roles for Tom's films or for, Paul has recently stepped into director boots away from producing, which he would have done for more than 20 years with us. But even though we would have all started in animation college and all been, all drawn together initially. Yeah, we kind of step in and out of each other's boots. And then depending, way back in my early career where we were working on shorts and things like that, you would do everything. Like you would also try and, finance and try and pull the budget together and the schedule together and that. And now we are we're about 160 people at the moment. It kind of fluctuates a little bit depending on what's going on. And so we have so many fantastic people working with us. We have finance, crew, and we've, accounts crew, and we've HR and all of these kind of, official titles that are much easier than the early days for sure.
Yes. In those early days, when you've been through that, you can do so many different things that that it kind of is remarkable to people. And at the same time, you're like, I did it to survive, we wouldn't have finished the project. Yeah.
Yeah. No, for sure. Absolutely. I remember with the shorts, with me and Numbers were not very good. I would easily drop a zero if I was in the middle of budgeting something and I kind of go, okay. So it wasn't great. It was out of necessity. Those early days. So it's great that there are people that are much better qualified.
Better at numbers.
A little bit better. Might explain why we were so poor in those days.
Yeah, yeah. So we had Tom on a year ago, Tom Moore, and heard his side of the journey. I'd love to hear anything about your perspective that wouldn't have been included by Tom. Just from your perspective, how was that journey? He's told me like the details of you got funding from a bank and
we did. Well, I guess, yeah. I mean, what I remember most vividly about the early years in particular. So we started back in 99 and Kells, I think, went into production in 2004.
Yeah.
And we'd made some short films. So I'd started out with a couple of short films. Some of them you can see on YouTube. There's one called From Darkness, which I distributed myself.
Wonderful.
the film board backed it, the film board here in Ireland. But I remember it was like I had four or five 35 millimeter prints of this nine minute short. And I was trying to organize, okay, if I see if I can get it into this film festival in France and then get the festival in France to courier it to the next festival in Italy or something, then I won't have to pay for the courier myself. And so I was, trying to literally, figure out All of that stuff. So yeah, I mean, the baptism of fire of having to do many things all at once, even realizing, oh, if I enter it into this film festival, that means that that film festival won't take it, you know?
I know, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, figuring all of that stuff out as you go, making those mistakes, you know, if somebody tells you that, you'll forget it. If you have to do it and you realize, you realize it yourself, you remember it forever. And so the strategy of publicizing your film and that is something that's kind of deeply ingrained, you know, no matter what the size of what you're working on is.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, the great thing is about making short films is it's kind of the same process for the larger films. You know, mm-hmm. you have to write it, board it, fund it, you know, get the sound done, you know, et cetera. So it's just on a much larger scale. And whereas if you go wrong with a short, and if you've, especially I think if you've come out of animation college, you can probably pull it together yourself, especially nowadays when you can, you know, the software isn't that expensive and, you know, computers are a lot more powerful than they used to be. Even if you make a bunch of mistakes, you can still pull it together. Mm-hmm. With a feature, you really can't. And because... No.
Yeah,
Kells was a co-production. It was fantastic. The film board here in Ireland put some money behind it for development. And then the first co-producer who came on board was from Les Amateurs studio in France, Didier Brunet, who was amazing. He just has such a trust in creative people and people who really want to get something made no matter what. And I think that's probably the most important feature in a director or producer is just that no matter what, I want to get this thing made. I want to make something. I want to put something out in front of an audience. I want to tell a story.
Yes.
That kind of conviction is, no matter what else you have, if you have that, then people will come behind you and come alongside you and get on board because they know they're not wasting their time, that you fully believe in what you're doing.
Yeah.
And so he was that kind of energy, Didier. And so he encouraged us to find our own voices at the time because, I think when we were in college was great, but it did teach us how to draw in a particular way. And, the syllabus was styled on the Sheridan curriculum mm-hmm. at the time. And so we would draw in a certain kind of way. And, you know, I suppose originality wasn't something that we really thought about strongly until we started, until the studio was up and running and we were trying to kind of figure out how does our stuff look? Because, mm-hmm. A lot of studios even now will say, okay, well, we want to be the next Disney or we want to, we want to.
Yes.
Make that four quadrant kind of, thing in a certain way or whatever. Whereas really, I think what people are crying out for is originality. And not seeing you if you're trying to be like somebody else, then it's hard to be authentic, I guess. If you find the universal within your own voice, then it's more unique.
I like that phrase, find the universal within your own voice.
Yeah, well, I think this is something that certainly myself and Tom and Paul really agree on about storytelling is, and I think every storyteller knows it, when you found something deep and truthful, then people really respond to it.
Yeah.
But it kind of has to cost you.
It does. Oh, I love that. Yes.
it has to be a little bit embarrassing or something that people might know something about you, kind of thing, because, if you put something onto the screen and actually it's might be related to something that happened to you in your childhood or a flaw you have and you know that if you have it, then other people have it too. And why we all tell stories is to not feel alone in the world and for us to feel that somebody else has gone through something that we've gone through. Stories bind us together. They always have since we were sitting around campfires. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, looking for that authenticity is something, and it's not something we always were conscious of. And it's not something that we always hit the mark with, mm-hmm. But it is, we are, continually trying for that going for it.
I love that. There's one of my friends who is in the story area, and he's brilliant, Brian McDonald, he often says that storytelling isn't self-expression, it's self-exposition. you're exposing things about yourself you wouldn't really like people to know, but you're doing it courageously, knowing that that's going to make a difference. It's going to bind people together. I love how you talked about binding people together. That's great.
But it's interesting because I've been thinking, you know, AI and all this kind of these discussions about, you know, AI in terms of story and in terms of animation and all of that kind of stuff. But ultimately, we're appealing to other human beings as artists and storytellers and animators. And even animator, like I remember even on My Father's Dragon, there was a scene toward the end where one of the animators had gotten their grandmother to walk so that we could get a certain weight in an older character's walk. I didn't know that she hadn't told me at the time, but I remember seeing it and just loving what she had done with it. I just responded to it instinctually because that's the way my mother used to walk, you know, and I don't know if that kind of stuff, like an animator drawing the person that they love and it's studying the way that they walk. And then, you know, me as a director responding to that in a way I can't even articulate, just going, oh, there's something really special about that piece of animation. I don't know if maybe it will. I don't know, but we're so highly tuned to understand when somebody's being false with us. Like if somebody's saying, "Oh, I love such a thing," and you know they don't really, or they're saying something that's not original to them, or something, you know. But yet they're characterizing it as that. Like we're tuned to. If somebody says, "I'm fine," and you can hear it in their voice that they're not really. We're so tuned to the falseness or the potential false, because it can be life and death, you know, from a primal kind of perspective as to whether you can believe somebody else or not. I don't know. Maybe we will. I don't know. Maybe. Yeah.
It's funny that AI has been so much in the public eye because it's really it's already been around. We've already been using it. Right. I type in an email and the email tries to suggest words for me to, you know, that's AI. Right. It's I actually have a buddy who can program AI and he says that AI is the wrong term for it. It's machine learning. You're teaching a machine to learn things and then it will help you more in brainstorming or more in. More in gathering information and just coming up with really quick iterations. But as far as like the human component, that's the part that you need to bring right to the table.
That is it. And like good stories, I think, really involve that kind of sacrifice and sacrifice it from storytellers telling something that you're a little bit ashamed of that you kind of don't really want to admit, but you have to in order to tell a good story. Don't know if we ever going to get there with an artificial way of coming at stories, because it's never going to cost an artificial being, I guess, or whatever, to really expose something about themselves.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I mean, there's kind of a dark thread too there, where well, perhaps it cost somebody else something, and artificial just snatched it and exposed it, you know. And that's kind of a scary kind of, you know, it's like, if I'm going to expose something, I want me to be the one to expose it, you know, not this other entity.
You have the makings of a good horror story there, Scott, I think.
Yes, I have. That whole debate has spawned tons of ideas for, I think, a lot of us who are, you know, generally, like, I think us artists, we really feel things really deeply, you know. Especially when we're trying to be vulnerable and honest with our storytelling. And so when I first started seeing that become so big, it really did rock me, you know. I had many sleepless nights of thinking about it and like what's my place in this, and does my place even matter, you know? And what are other artists gonna do, like Nora, Tom? And I also think of we mentioned G Kids, you know, anytime I see a Studio Ghibli film or a Cartoon Saloon film on the shelf, I want to buy it, even though I already own it, you know. There's something about that, you know, there's something special there. We live in this economy where everybody's seeking attention, right? And they get attention in quick ways, but then there are projects like the ones that we're trying to craft that we can bring people back into it over and over again without having to advertise it to them over and over again and say, hey, look at me. I have some cool thing AI spit out, you know?
So. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. I think if you do spend time with something and you have the time of, you know, a couple of hundred people who would have given, you know, a couple of years of their lives to try and, you know, help form something that is of meaning, then that's timeless. It really is.
Yeah.
I look at my own kids and how, one of my kids, like since he was three, he's gone back to Kung Fu Panda over and over again. Uh-huh. And it means different things to him at different times in his life. But there's something in it for him. There's something that's a companion for him, you know, in his life. And it's lovely to see that. How stories can be a companion to you, and how you can see them from different perspectives. My husband and I were watching Sunset Boulevard.
Oh,
recently.
Me too.
So now,
within a month.
Yeah. So yeah. Now,
yeah.
So I remember watching it as a student and going, "Oh my God, this is great!" And like, what an amazing film and beautiful and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But now that I am, you know, probably Norma Desmond's age, I can't watch it because I suddenly really identify with her. Whereas before, I was identifying with the young writer going out and, you know, having, you know, with all these, you know, cool friends and everything. Goodness. And now suddenly I'm Norma Desmond. I'm going, I can't watch this. It's too tragic. It's too dreadful. You know, so I stopped halfway through and went, okay, maybe when I'm older again, when I'm Norma Desmond's mother's age, I can watch it or something. But
yes.
It's funny just seeing the same story from different perspectives, either as your skill grows or your experience grows, or just yourself as a human being grow, you know, and the more experiences you rack up. It's interesting. I'd love to have written down what I thought about the film initially so that I could now write down what I think about it, you know, and see how my perspective has changed.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing. There was a film called, it's in the public consciousness. Grave of the Fireflies was a film that I watched. Somebody recommended it to me right as I was about to be laid off at Rhythm and Hues. And, you know, my family had gone to Utah and I'm sitting there watching Grave of the Fireflies of these two children starving to death. And that is not, when you're about to be laid off, that is not the film you want to watch. You know, I sobbed. It was tragic. And I could not bring myself to watch that movie until this year. You know, and yeah. Then watched it. And it was interesting because now that I'm past that, it was therapeutic. Like it became one of the sweetest, most beautiful films I'd ever seen, you know, in a way.
Yeah. It's an absolutely incredible film. And I don't know many people who can watch it many times. I had the similar experience, Scott, where there's something very loving in that film, in the way the animators give such beautiful attention to everything, every single detail. And even though the animation is at times what you consider limited, there is mm-hmm. such beautiful decisions into mm-hmm. what to show in movement, what to show in a pose. You know, the compositions are, there's something about the style of animation and the direction and the decision making that are kind of loving things. There's something, again, you know, particular about the hand drawn nature of it, mm-hmm. which is another element of, you know, those scenes that are, you know, extremely moving, mm-hmm. that a lot of people spent a lot of time making sure that those moments were marked. And so people who lost their lives at the time when the, you know, where the film was, you know, based mm-hmm. and that moment in history, it felt like they were being honored and they were being spent, having time spent on them in a way that's kind of distilled and in a way that's not so, it's not horrific, you know, it's, mm-hmm. It's like a distilled experience or something where you can, you know, you can kind of step as far back as you want from it or come as close. And again, depending on what time of your life, if you have, you know, if you have young kids in particular, it's almost impossible to watch, but it's just the power of it. It's almost like staring at the sun or something. It's almost, it's so powerful.
Yeah.
And yet distilled. It's really,
I like that idea of distilled. Yeah. There's a moment in it that's so small and subtle, but when he brings her food and she's made all these mud balls and she says they're rice balls, you know, that moment really hit me hard. And it's so small and so subtle, and yet it hits me harder than if I saw a bloody scene where somebody's arm got cut off, you know.
Yeah, the way that, again, it's the observation of how children can normalize extra, and the younger they are, the more they'll normalize it, like extraordinary circumstances, and make a little bit of imagination out of it or something, you know, where Whereas, yeah, you would think looking from the outside, oh, you know, that child should be expressing that they're really hungry or that they're really, you know, tired and angry or whatever. But no, it's just that thing that, you know, we all played with mud or with, you know, whatever, you know, the elements and pretended there was something else. And to see a child in that circumstance, yeah, you're right. Those are the really, really powerful moments and such amazing directing to be able to choose something like that and knowing the full power of it, you know, whether intellectually or, you know, from the heart, probably not intellectually, probably exclusively from the heart.
Yeah.
In order for it to kind of connect with people all around the world forever. You know, this is the thing as well. I mean, that film in 50 years time, if we're still around, will be celebrated as much, and that those moments will be experienced in the, like, the timeless manner that they are. You know, that's not a piece of, you know, CGI from 15 years ago that already looks dated, or it's not a very now idea that is, you know, surfacey or whatever. These kind of, you know, beautiful explorations of what it is to be human is absolutely timeless.
Yeah. I love how you differentiated the mind from the brain too. I think nowadays, especially, I don't know about in up where you live, but down here, it seems like, we focus too much on the intellect, you know, and that's, yeah, there's much more to a human being than just the brain, you know, there's the foot, the hand, the knee, you know,
the
heart,
I mean,
the lungs, you know, there's just so much.
Yeah, I think from a writing perspective, most writers I know do really, you know, come from the heart. You know, they really do. And, you know, I know, like, you know, the bigger your budget and the bigger the risk for a studio or whatever, like, the more voices are going to be involved in a story, and the more you need everybody to be kind of, you know, walking in the one direction. You know, and you want to make sure that everybody's on the same page. And even though, as a storyteller, you should always look for people to challenge you in a positive way, so that you're not just doing the first thing that comes into your head, or you're not doing, you know, something that's been unchallenged. You know, sometimes if you're working on something, and you might be working on it for weeks, and you need to be in a cave, so to speak, in order to kind of get, you know, those first ideas out there, and to get those first moments, you really do need other voices, I suppose, to come in and give you a perspective on it, I guess, and somebody mm-hmm. else's perspective. But again, in that way that, you know, that you're all kind of speaking the same language. Mm-hmm. But you're right. There can be a lot of, very intellectual kind of, you know, decisions as to what should happen and what part in a movie and not another or whatever. Or there can be fear about, you know, trying new things mm-hmm. or, you know, going a little bit out there mm-hmm. or, you know, Guillermo del Toro talked so much this year about and last year about not treating animation as a genre where you have to have a funny sidekick and you have to have mm-hmm. a moment where the character, you know, expresses to camera who they are. And, you know, so to try and pull things away from those kind of genre-esque or tropey kind of moments. But then it's funny, you know, audiences can expect that at the same time. You know, I was right across the way from a cinema, and it's just interesting watching films with parents and young children, and I think children will they'll take any experience, you know, they'll grow with any experience. Either stuff will go over their head if you've got nice layered storytelling, or they'll engage with it in a way that that is appropriate for them. But oftentimes parents, I think, can say, okay, well, you know, I'm sitting here in this film, and there better be something for me. So they better have had, you know, the voice cast of somebody from my youth, so that I can go, oh, there's that person, I can keep interested, and the couple of jokes that go over the kids' heads and, you know, and go into my ears. So there can be, I think people do expect some, you know, sometimes I think because of the way that we've watched animation and as a cultural thing in the US and in Ireland and the UK, and Europe as well. We want, you know, a certain type of animation for most of our childhoods and most of our lives. And so watching animation such as Grave of the Fireflies, you know, I've been to film festivals where, you know, children have been in, you know, films that they really shouldn't be in. Just because they're animated, they think, okay, well, it must be a kid's film because it's animated.
Yeah.
It's, 3D or it's 2D or whatever.
That makes sense for sure. The there's also an interesting thing about seeing a film alone. I think My Major Totoro is this way. Song of the Sea was this way. Secret of Kells is this way. Even Wolfwalkers was this way. I saw My Father's Dragon with my kids the first time, so I wouldn't know about that one. But seeing it as an adult was one experience. And then seeing it with kids creates a whole new experience for watching the film. My Neighbor Totoro in particular, I think that film was not magical to me until I saw it with kids. And then all of a sudden, it was this completely different film. And that's neat.
Yeah, they make it their own completely. You're absolutely right. And what you think is going to connect with them mightn't. And and all children are different. And, mm-hmm. you know, I remember watching The Red Turtle, Michael uh-huh. Didotowicz, the Red Turtle with my kids and their cousins. And they all kind of sat down. It was at home, so we watched it, and they sat down on the couch, and the film started, they began to speak, and I was going to tell them, shh, you know, be quiet, but then I didn't. I just was listening, and they were figuring out what was going on with the characters, and they were answering each other with it, and they were deeply engaged, like extremely engaged, but they were the soundtrack to the film.
Yeah.
There was a whole, and there were times where their conversation would fall away and they would just kind of, you know, watch, and then it would spark up again. And it was like another element. It was like Michael had left 60%, even though the film like is it was already 100% for me, but like he had left for that. I don't know, it was a magic moment. Yeah, watching mm-hmm. watching the film was incredible. But he left so much space for them to participate in the film. It was incredible, and I'd never thought of animation really like that. It was just amazing.
Amazing. My goodness.
Yeah. Me watching it was on my own was a completely different thing. I'd already watched it at that point. And, I'm going to show them. And then I was going to tell them all to shut up.
Yeah. With my short film Layers, it was very interesting. With adults, I got these very different responses. There were some adults that would be like, I didn't get it. There were some adults that were like, you're playing 4D chess here. This is really layered, and there's all kinds of cool things in it. And then there were some adults that were just, I like it, right? But with kids, it seemed universally, they just knew it. They knew what it was about. They could tell me what it was about. They were really engaged with it, you know? It was almost like there was more of a universal experience with the children than with the adults, too. So that was fascinating to see.
I wonder... Yeah, I guess children, even though they often look like they're not listening, or they don't look like they're paying attention, whatever, they actually do mm-hmm. on a much greater level than adults. Adults often will watch something and try to form an opinion on it
yeah.
instead of just let it wash over them.
Right.
We had a similar enough experience when early on with The Breadwinner, before it was released, probably halfway through production, we went and took a lot of... students, teenagers to watch the film with their teachers and some of their parents. I stood in the lobby of the cinema afterwards and saw the children coming out, and they're all talking to each other, you know, and then the adults came out with, you know, red eyes and said, you know, I really don't think that's, you know, it's too much, you know, too much for children and that, but the kids were fine. You know, this is so adults thinking about how a child was going to interpret this or was interpreting it was upsetting for the adult.
Yeah.
You know, rather than just, and again, children, and especially like I said, if you're aware of how you're telling a story and aware of how you're layering it, then they'll get what they're able to get in the way they're able to get it. Mm-hmm. Like me with Sunset Boulevard, you know, there was a whole level of horror there that I wasn't aware of until I came close to Norma Desmond's age. Yeah. The story is constantly surprising.
It makes me wonder if there's a trick that a filmmaker could use, not a trick, but a tool that a filmmaker could use to get adults in that space, you know, the space where it's like, oh, we're kind of kids again, you know, we can just let the film wash over us and have an experience.
I wonder about it's great seeing actually the cinema that's across the way filling up quite a bit now again, which is fantastic, because after COVID, we weren't sure what was going to happen or whether people would be so used to watching things in their living room that they wouldn't want to go back to the cinema. But there is that thing you were talking about earlier, the shared experience when you're feeling something very emotional and there's a stranger that's sitting over there and they're feeling emotional about it too. And there's something really affirming about it to think that we're both human beings and we can watch something, you know, happen with a character and both, you know, there's something, there's an energy in that, that is amazing. But I wonder with everybody's concentration spans these days, you know, I notice myself the amount of, you know, my concentration span, because I'm bombarded with, you know, things, social media and even choice, like so much choice. I went to see, I can't think of the name, Smooth Talk, a film from the 1980s. Mm-hmm. I went to see it at a festival, at Virginia Film Festival last year. And it was the first time in a long time where I'd been to see a film that I didn't really intend to go, that somebody else, my producer, Julie Lynn, bought tickets for it. We went to see it. And it was an amazing film, a story, you know, a really nuanced, brilliant story told in a way like I really wouldn't have chosen in a million years to watch that film. I just wouldn't have struck me as something that I wanted to see. It kind of made me yearn for a time where, you know, in the summertime, you had maybe one or two films that might come up that, you know, there would be, you know, there's something that you want to see, or you wouldn't be such a, you know, six or seven films every week that, you know, that.
Yeah. What are you going to watch? So, before we do a deep dive into your process, we've just been talking a lot about our favorite stuff, which is great. There's a person named Mona from France, an animation student. She's just talked about how Cartoon Saloons or films are such a huge inspiration and thanks you for your wonderful work and wonders what advice you'd give to an aspiring storyteller.
Thank you for the question. It's an interesting one. I think there is so many, just even on YouTube, there are so many different resources, you know, different podcasts out there in terms of writers sharing their process. There is so many, every year, there are so many interviews out there with different directors and writers and filmmakers and actors. So you get to see it from, you get to see storytelling from so many different perspectives. I would absorb as much of that as you can, Mona, but I would also just live. I think there's nothing just live, like, you know,
live,
you know,
a life.
Your experiences, take the bus, chat to someone, you know, that you might ordinarily chat to, maybe somebody outside of your, you know, your usual circle, try and take opportunities. I'm very, as a person, I'm very introverted, but I keep trying to push out the, but, you know, push myself out there in ways that I'm not comfortable with, just in order to, I feel like if I didn't do that, that my bubble would keep getting smaller and smaller until like going outside my door would be an issue for me. So I keep pushing that out. But then when I do, I'm always so inspired just by other human beings. And so just making sure that you, and, you know, keeping a journal, so that if do, you know, meeting interesting people or, you know, even hearing about something interesting on the news that you might have a perspective on, that you mightn't agree with in a year's time or whatever, like that, just thinking as deeply as you can, questioning as much as you can, writing as much as you can. I mean, that's what, and again, a lot of writers will, you know, and storytellers will talk about just doing it, like as an inspiration is never going to hit you when you're, you know, when you're, sitting, you know, on a mountain or something like that, staring out into space, is probably going to hit you when you've written something that's so god awfully, embarrassingly awful that you have to rewrite it 7 times. And maybe on the 8th time, you might get it. Or when you show it to somebody else and they might say, oh, well, maybe if you try it this way, that's when it might start to work. So a lot of it is just writing. You know, if you're a writer, then keep writing. If you're a storyboarder, keep storyboarding. If you're a director or you want to be a director, try and experience as many different disciplines as you can. And that doesn't mean you have to be a compositor and a storyboarder and an editor, but you do have to have a good understanding of what those people do and how they can help you and how you can help them tell the best stories that you can. Just trying to soak up as much experience as you can, and you know, also go easy on yourself, you know, like I said,
live.
Live.
I think you even snuck some advice in where we didn't realize it. Don't be Norma Desmond, you know. Norma Desmond, if you've seen Sunset Boulevard, she was such a scrappy, like really hardworking actress. She makes her mark, she becomes famous, but then when the success is removed, she was so removed from life, she couldn't live anymore. She had to just always look back at the past and relive that. And so she was living in the land of the dead pretty much, you know, for the rest of her life. And so I think that advice, just live. That's really good advice. You know, we're not just here to make stuff. We're here also to experience. That's awesome. I love, let's do a deep dive into your process. Like, how would you describe your process of directing a film?
Well, it's interesting because right now I'm back at the beginning and like, you know, drawing a lot. I've got some drawings on the notice board behind me, and writing and studying again. So I'm gone back to studying life drawing and studying screenwriting again. So even though I've been, you know, doing this in some shape or form for nearly 25 years, you have to keep learning and relearning and always, you know, assume that you know nothing because no matter how many times you get into, you know, the whole storytelling process, and the more you think, okay, well, the last project I learned this and this, and I learned that I should do this and I shouldn't do that, you're going to make new mistakes on your next project. And, you know, with even the team of people that you're working with, if you're lucky enough to work with some of the people, again, you will, as even a group of people, it'll be a whole other thing. Every film is its own thing. And even though, you know, I remember on The Secret of Kells, in the middle of it, we were making the film mostly on paper. It was a co-production across a number of different countries. So we were shipping paper from country to country and hoping that it would all come together as a film in the end. You know, it was a difficult process. We learned a lot on it. The Secret of Kells, I remember really interested in, because we were growing so much as storytellers, just trying to do that thing of layered story where children wouldn't be, you know, utterly traumatized by the climax of the film, trying to layer the story in a way where we weren't showing everything that we were kind of the themes that we were exploring. We weren't pushing them all onto the screen in a way that that was going to exclude some of our younger audience. In animation, of course, your screenplay goes through the ringer quite a bit in animatic. So we traditionally here, you do about 6 or 7 drafts of a script. You think, you know, okay, well, this is it. This is the film. Yeah. You take it into animatic, you know, by about halfway through that first pass of animatic, you have to bring your writer back and you're saying, okay, well, you know, this thing that we, you know, looks so good on the page, it doesn't quite work when you really start to, you know, involve the visuals and make sure that the visual storytelling is up there front and central. And so you start to try and take the things apart that aren't quite working there. Oftentimes while you have a team of people, you might have layout people that are looking to start on the project. You have a storyboarding team that are all looking for briefs and that, and you might need to start taking the story asunder. Again, we try to work really roughly in storyboard animatic. We try not to be seduced by the beauty of, you know, gorgeous panels. We like our panels in storyboarding are working panels. We do have, you know, scene illustrations, and we do have, you know, our art director will have a really good handle on how the film looks and how the storyboarding process feeds into the art direction and vice versa. But we work that storyboard for, you know, at least four or five passes. And again, like usually the beautiful storyboards that are left are the ones, you know, are the few, you know, on your last pass of your animatic, you've got the scrappiest of drawings, as you really feverishly work to figure out that story. We'll do like a temp track of like the voice track before we bring on our actors, just to make sure that we not to be prescriptive for the actors or anything like that. It's just actually to know how much freedom they have. So if your actor comes in, because it's an expensive part of the process, you also mightn't have great access to your actors. So knowing what you want from them is great. Being able to describe it, and especially if you're dealing with younger cast members, you do need to kind of know your animatic in your head without having to play it. And you also need to know like something that I find kind of interesting with the storyboarding process, and then our voice actors and the physicality that's needed from voice actors, even though they're in a dark room with a microphone and they can hear their own voices really clearly in their headphones. And that oftentimes even the most experienced actors will get very low and intimate with their performances. So you have to keep it saying, okay, well, actually, the camera's way over there and you're running now, and you know, and there's somebody chasing you, and that's how, you know, your line is coming across. But their actors are like big kids, they're incredible imaginations, and they're you know, it really is like playing at that point. But I'm also really conscious at that point that you have to bring back performances that the animators can really jump on, as in like the actors have to the performances that you choose from the actors have to be so believable and so good and so truthful that the animators can say, okay, now I can spend a week working on maybe, four or five seconds of this, and I can give it my all because the actor has also given their all to this. And so your animators are so much of the performance of the characters, of course, as well. So the voice is one thing, but the physical performance comes from the animators, and then your team of animators all working together. So if you have a team of animators working on your main, you know, your protagonist, that they're all working in a collaborative way, so that if somebody decides that, okay, well, this character, every time they think about something, they scratch the back of their head, then that information gets, you know, followed through to an animator who might be working in a different country, who you might never meet, who can then carry on those, you know, those wonderful gestures, so that your character always feels like the same character and not the personality of each animator as the film progresses. There are so many different stages to animation, and there are so many different departments, and all of these departments have to work together so well, and each department head is head of maybe, you know, 30, 40 people. We do things called the kind of director's passes, where your director and your directing team will just talk with all of the supervisors and heads of departments about what's important with each sequence as you launch it in production, because it's easy to get lost in the weeds. It's easy to think that something is important, like in 2D animation, if something's happening with the model, you know, that wasn't intended, that can become the focus of everybody's attention. But maybe it's not that important, because maybe, you know, the face is important in those scenes, or that's what's carrying the performance. So making sure that your directing team always can help the heads of departments and every single person working on the film to spend most of their time on the thing that's most important in those shots, in those scenes, and not to worry about things, because, you know, your scenes will never be perfect. There's always going to be something wrong. And your job as a director isn't to go for absolute perfection, that everything is right with you're never going to have the money or the time, no matter what your budget is, to do that. Yeah, your job is to concentrate on what's important in those scenes, making sure that comes across, and then, you know, maybe letting go of the smaller stuff that means that your team still have energy for what they have to do the next week. A lot of times, if a director is really unsure, it's hard for them to express exactly, you know, what they want, and it's hard for them to approve scenes because they're not sure if they have it or not yet. And then it's also hard for them to gauge how to spend the time and energy of the crew, because you need energy for the end of the production. You need, you know, you don't know what it costs when you make somebody do something over and over again. Oh. It's not important.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah,
and you also need people around you who you can really trust to help you at those times where you might lose perspective, and to be able to ask them, you know, that thing where the hand is moving, you know, at the edge of the screen, is that important or not? Or like, are you watching that? Are you watching the character's face? And if they say it's really not important, then just let it go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually gave a note to an animator this morning that I've given them the same note, and I keep seeing the error there. And I was like, I'm about to give you this note, but I'm not going to, because I don't even know if it's that big of a deal, you know? And, a little light bulb went on, thinking, you know, I wonder if sometimes we just spend so much time, like we might spend 10 hours on this thing that, like you said, is in the weeds, when really the overall thing was working. Maybe we just ignore that for a while and it won't become important anymore.
Yeah. There's a pattern to that. And the more you direct, the more you realize that. I realize at the end of a production, there's always going to be like one thing that I think is like the biggest thing in the world. And it's not.
And nobody notices
just because
it.
And really what's going on is I'm just not psychologically kind of, you know, equipped to let go of the project now. And that's what's going on. So now being Norma Desmond's age, I'm able to kind of notice that, okay, that's what's going on now. So I just need to stop that now and, you know, and let it go. You know? there are so many, and every director is different, and every, you know, director comes, you know, you've directors coming from animation, directors coming from writing, directors coming from editing or from live action or whatever, you know, so everybody has a very different approach. And even what is most important to them about filmmaking is different from director to director.
Yeah. We have another question from Tito James, and he, I hope I said that name. It might be right. Tito. It might be Tito. I'm not sure. But, he'd like to have us discuss a little bit more about animation not being a genre, but being a medium. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Part of that comes from like the long history of how animation was formed. It was a very family-friendly thing. And now we have several people wanting to push it more, like projects like Arcane, or to push it more in an adult direction.
Yeah, what well, there always was, you know, there always has been animation that has, you know, gone in different directions and used medium for different types of stories. It's just, it is just the big blockbuster, you know, four quadrant type of film that actually even uses the same kind of performances oftentimes, like this kind of almost like musical, you know, like a dancer like kind of performances from characters that are really pushed, and then other, you know, directors will use animation for very naturalistic performances, you know, in ways I think because of choice, you know, we were talking about choice and how much choice there is now. I am happy though to see that even though like things can absolutely get lost in streaming services, there are so many different choices that, you know, there are films that pop up on different streaming services that you might never have thought of clicking on before, and you just give it a chance, like 5 minutes, and you go, oh my gosh, I never thought animation could be like this. I know, I didn't think that I would connect with something like this. And I'm, you know, I think that that's broadening people's expectations. You know, even YouTube, or, you know, like, you know, even short form, you know, the access back when I, you know, the film that I was talking about with the 35 millimeter print, like there is so many, you know, once that film's festival life was over, that was it kind of thing. Whereas now you can make a film, you might never put it into a festival, but you might put it up on you know, YouTube or something like that, or put parts of it up on something, and a lot of people can, you know, get to see it. So I think that it's broadening people's expectation of animation. When you think about even, you know, what animation is, I mean, you know, Avatar is an animated film, even though it's not advertised as such yet, you know, some incredible animators worked on it and really honed those, you know, yeah, incredible performances. They had massive teams, much bigger than
Steamroller worked on that. Yeah, several of the artists I've worked with have worked on that.
So this is it. You know, it's like, what even is animation? You know, mm-hmm. or you go to, you know, any of the superhero
everything's
films,
animation
like,
now.
They're 80% animation. So
yeah.
So even what, you know, when people say, oh, but, you know, your film has to have a sidekick and you have to have a magic element and you have to have a song and you have to have, you know, that's a particular type of thing that people are pointing at. And then you get funneled into that. If you're making a film that's for kids and for adults, I think if you're making a film just for adults, and that's a hard sell because, you know, I don't know. It can be a hard sell if you're looking for funding to, but sometimes I think it's better just to jump with 2 feet and just say, okay, my film is for adults. The type of design that I'm choosing is not signaling to younger audiences. It's got a sophistication or something that's signaling to older audiences. I think if you are aware of all the signals that you're sending and then, you know, do that, then your film is, then nobody's going to ask of it. Like Flea, for example, I don't think anybody was asking, you know, in the film Flea, which is about an Afghan refugee. I don't think they were thinking about, where's the sidekick and where's the song moment and where's the, you know, where are the gags, where's the gag pass on that, you know, kind of thing. So I think if your signals are all tonally in the same vein, then no one's going to ask that question. But I think the more money you ask for and the more you're asking for family audiences, you are going to come up against that. But I think it's being, you know, reinvented all the time. And I think that films like, you know, Spider-Verse and, you know, that's being, you know, challenged as well. And people's
things,
expectations. People aren't, you know, feeling shortchanged if they don't get exactly what they think they should get.
We're coming up toward the end of this, and my question I usually ask is the Get Wiser moment. You actually already touched on this subject multiple times, but the question is, if my goal is to get the highest clarity of truth into a story, what approach would you recommend?
The highest clarity of truth.
I said truth. I might change the word to meaning. I changed it to meaning last time. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I get, I think if you can really, like, in an honest as a way as possible, like, move yourself with what you're doing, you know, and you can, I think you, if you hit it and you feel the power of it, and if others feel it too, like, if, and again, you have to be careful with who you, especially with animatics and things like that, you have to be careful with who you ask advice from and make sure that there are people that are in the same sensibility as you. They don't need to be in animation or whatever, but they do need to. Because, you know, I've heard, you know, situations where you get like a whole bunch of directors into a room and they're all like, well, what I would do there is I do this and I do that. You're not going to.
Worst advice is what you would do.
They're just, you know, proving how clever they are as opposed to kind of helping you with the story that you're telling or understanding what the story is that you're telling. So oftentimes the best people to ask are editors and writers and people who are actors, you know, people who are used to kind of working in a very collaborative, you know, that it's not, you know, that you're not asking auteurs, I guess.
Yeah.
And then I think Meg LaFoe, who's the writer on My Father's Dragon, was saying that you have to be careful who you ask permission for, because some self-sabotaging thing that you can do when you come up with an idea is tell the person first who's going to knock it down. So you don't have to do it and it doesn't have to be a failure, you know? So I thought it was really wise, as to, like, just being careful of yourself. You just don't, you know, don't, you know, I, and again, like, you know, through my career, I've met people who said, well, I would have done this, you know, I would have followed this career path, but somebody at some point told me I shouldn't, or I couldn't.
Yeah.
So I didn't. And going, well, but they don't have power over you, you know, and, you know, and not that, you know, like, people, you know, are wounded for different reasons. And oftentimes people ask, others for permission and they don't need to, so the truth, I think you'll feel it. And then the thing is that when you do, it's probably going to be really scary because again, you feel exposed.
Yes.
You feel like, oh no. And you know, that this is something I don't really want people to know. And they'll probably see right through and they'll go, oh my God, that's because you know? So, but then just being really courageous. Yeah. But being courageous with that.
Yeah.
Because if you're able to touch that moment within yourself, maybe it's coming from something that happened to you or somebody that happened, something that happened, or something that you, like I said, something that you're maybe not that proud of or whatever in yourself, others will respond to it, you know, as well. And even so, your audience will, but your team will too. If they know that the story that you're telling has cost you something, then they'll say, okay, well, I'm going to spend this year working on that then, because if it costs you, then I can trust you.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and I think if you have that, and just hold on to it, because it's really lightning. It's really, you know, it's difficult, and it's difficult to hold on to, and it can be destroyed so easily. And, you know, so, and you have to be, but you also have to be prepared for that. It might not work. You might feel it, and you know, you have to just go with it anyway, you know, if you succeed, you succeed. If you fail, you fail, but you just have to, you know, get up and go again and be resilient, you know, just follow your passion.
Yeah. That's great advice. I love that. Also, when showing it to people, I had an experience this week where I had just sent it off to a potential deal person. And and then immediately I could see what was wrong with it. And so I went and showed it to some people, and all they told me was, oh, it's great, I love it. But I was like, I'm going to change it anyway. So I went in because I could just feel there was something not clicking in the honesty area about it. And then showed it again, and it actually did click better with the people, you know. So you have to really listen to that. And so that's amazing advice. Wonderful advice.
Yeah. Yeah. And not listening. I mean, again, because like if you ask for notes from everyone, you'll get notes from everyone. But if you're getting the same note a lot of times, or if there's one that really kind of, you know, you might first say, oh no, that's all completely wrong. And why I did that was, you know, blah, 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 blah.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But then that night you're thinking about it still. Those are the ones that you have to listen to. The ones that kind of haunt you and that follow you around.
Haunt you, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Wonderful. Well, is there anywhere you'd like people to engage with you or your work at the moment?
Well, Cartoon Saloon, we have a number of things coming up. We have Screecher's Reach, the Star Wars Vision short is coming up on May the 4th.
Oh, nice.
Yes, on Disney Plus. We have a number of, you know, projects in development. We have a preschool show that's in production called City Sundays for HBO Max. We have Puff and Rock, which is a preschool show, which is a beautiful feature film, which is going to be released in Ireland this summer. But so just on Cartoon Saloon, social media, Instagram, you know, Twitter, etc. Yeah.
And those links are all down there in the bio, in the show notes. So great. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. And until next time.
Thank you very much,
Scott. Yeah, my pleasure. Until next time, I hope we all get a little wiser.
Thank you for watching the Directing Animation Livecast, hosted by Scott Weiser, audio version edited by Kira Horowitz, copyright Scott Weiser LLC 2022. Don't forget to subscribe on YouTube and ring that notification bell.